Open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for the final time, probably, this session for Thursday, May 28th. We got a lot on the agenda. We're going to try to move through this as quickly as we possibly can. We'll start by opening a work session on House Bill 3379A. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 3379A is the bill that allows cities to apply for extensions or submit alternatives if unable to meet the transportation funding requirements when amending comprehensive plans in compliance with the transportation planning rule. You have four amendments that you have adopted, the A5, the A6, the A7, and the A8. And we now have the paperwork on all those.
Okay, and colleagues, we did get a fiscal back on the A6, which I think is a great idea. Senator George has kindly allowed us to wait till February to do that so we can move this bill with the other important elements in it. So I would ask for a motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules so we can reconsider the vote by which we adopted the A6 amendments into House Bill 3379.
Senator Starr has moved that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the motion which we adopted, the A6 amendment to House Bill 3379. Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move that we remove the A6 amendments from House Bill 3379.
Senator Starr has moved the removal of the dash A6 amendments from House Bill 3379. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the bill as amended to this House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3379 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
One down.
Okay.
Do you have someone you'd like to lead the orchestra?
That's a multiple. I'll let Senator Telfer carry it, and then if she needs some help on the other issues, I'll do it. How's that? Okay, we're going up a work session on House Bill 2739. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2739 modifies the motor vehicle inventory for which the dealer may be allowed fair and reasonable compensation upon termination. You have the dash A6 amendment, which requires a manufacturer to provide within the 30 days specific reasons why a dealer's franchise has been canceled and other franchise provisions. It declares an emergency effective upon passage.
And we've already adopted the A6, correct?
You've adopted the A6.
Okay.
And
What we're going to do, colleagues, is, and I know we've received an email from Mr. Campbell. The General Motors had some issues about it. It would be the chair's decision to go ahead. It didn't establish a hue angst for me, but I did tell Mr. Campbell, if upon further review, there are some things we actually have to do language-wise. We'd go to conference and do that. But we will. We don't have the fiscal paperwork at the moment, and I would need a motion to suspend the rules to consider moving the bill without the fiscal statement.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the purpose of moving the bill without a fiscal.
Senator Starr has moved that we suspend the rules for the purpose of moving House Bill 2739 without the fiscal statement in possession. Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2739 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'll carry that one. Okay. Move it up to a work session on House Bill 3039. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, this is your solar pilot project bill. It directs the Public Utility Commission to establish a pilot program. You have the dash A11, which you adopted, and you have the dash A16. I don't know if you want me to explain the
Please.
Revenue problem that we had on the A11. The A11 modifies the original bill, and when they do a revenue analysis, they look at the amendment with the original bill. So that would have been quite a revenue impact because the original bill has the tax credits in it. The dash A16, on the other hand, replaces the bill and does not have a revenue impact. So you have the dash A16, which just arrived yesterday.
So the end result is, while we won't have the paperwork exactly right, we do have the fiscals, and together the 16 and 11 will be no fiscal. So we're going to keep the 11 that we've adopted. We are now going to replace the bill with the pilot program, and that's what we will be sending to the House, the Senate floor. And as I mentioned the other day, the primary purpose of this is to allow another week to consider this bill with a little bit more vigor for the possibility of the conference committee, because it's a very important issue, and we don't want it just to send something that's crippled to the floor. We want to make sure that we have a good product. So I've already talked to Representative Reed. In fact, we'll be meeting with the PUC this afternoon to kind of lay out a process for starting that discussion. So we need the A16, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the -A16 amendments to House Bill 3039.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved the -16 amendment to House Bill 3039. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3039 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Chairman?
Yes, Senator George.
I just want to, I would hope as we move forward that we treat all small and large solar companies as similar as possible. So I just want to encourage that.
I appreciate that. And Senator George, one of the values of the committee closing down is that any of the members who have some time next week, we're going to have meetings on this. No, seriously. And if you'd like to participate in that, because we're not going to have a lot of time and we need all the expertise we can to see if we can reach an understanding. Senator Schrader.
I just wanted to express a similar sentiment as my colleague, Senator George. We do want to have some equality of treatment. So, and thank you for giving us more meetings.
Yeah, we will let the sun shine in.
More meetings.
Yeah, Mr. Stanbridge.
And Mr. Chairman, I wanted to make sure the members know that we have adopted the -A11 and the -A16.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Any objection to the motion moving the bill to the floor? All right. So ordered. Senator Starr?
You want to carry that?
Sure.
Talk about solar and what we're going to do with it?
I love solar. I love the sun. I've made that a
sun. If you're in the audience for the purposes of the work session on House Bill 2457, plumbers, we're not going to be doing that bill today. Okay.
That's
okay.
Those people.
That's okay. That's okay.
Some Shields is here. So.
I got to wait to. I don't think on these are Senator Representatives. I got to do those in order. No offense, I've got an organization here on this last day. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2569. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2569 establishes the Consular Corps registration plates. You have the -A2 amendment, which authorizes surcharge for issuance of registration plates on behalf of nonprofit groups to be set by administrative rule, not less than $2.50, nor more than $16 per plate. And you have the -A4, which authorizes nonprofit group registration plates for fallen public safety officers to include the decal.
Okay. So this is one we heard the other day. And thanks to Senator George for his help in making this move forward. And we've adopted the amendments, correct, El Mundo?
Yes, you have adopted the -A2 and the -A4.
And we're ready to go, right?
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2569 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Let's see. Is there any of our colleagues on the original bill? Can I wait to determine a carrier in case there's somebody that I can't remember from the original bill? This, and if not,
sure, it's
I'll
just
sign.
A matter of
yeah, not like carrier.
Okay, and if not, if there's not one who's on the original bill, then Senator George will carry.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's a committee bill.
Yeah, but I mean the original one that we did for this bill. Right. Okay, I got to wait for that one. Representative Bruin in here?
Mr. Chairman, we sent out the information that it would be about 1:45. Figuring
okay,
that
we're doing a little better than we thought, aren't we? Okay, let's do. We're going to be sending this one to Rules 3201. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3201, Oregon Liquor Control Commission. If you also send it to Rules, if that's okay. Mr. Timberg? 3201? Here it is. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3201 authorizes the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to place restrictions on licenses of premises if the licensee is experiencing serious or persistent problems. And the restrictions would be for the purpose of preventing the problems. It establishes the measure does not apply to an off-premises sales licensee.
Okay. I'll ask the proponents to come up first. Teresa, is it Marchetti? Marchetti. And Matt Jaffe? Jaffe? Jaffe. And in the on-deck circle will be Paul Romaine and Mark Nelson. Welcome.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Jaffe. I'm with the City of Portland, and I appreciate your time this afternoon. Coming before you today in support of House Bill 3201A, and I want to draw your attention to a letter I've submitted that you'll see from Commissioner Amanda Fritz in support of the bill. We have been working with Representative Esquivel and Representative Kotek, who are the sponsors of this bill, and participated in a work group convened by Representative Kotek. Happy to answer any questions. I'll be deferring to Teresa Marchetti with the City's Office of Neighborhood Involvement, who's our expert on OLCC matters.
Okay.
But happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and go with Teresa.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you in support of House Bill 3201A. For the record, I am Teresa Marchetti. As the coordinator of the City of Portland's liquor program, I work directly with neighborhoods, with businesses, and community members to problem solve neighborhood livability concerns and public safety issues at the lowest possible level. We help to ensure that all liquor establishments meet the high expectations of our community and operate in a lawful manner that does not unreasonably disturb the peace and tranquility of our neighborhood. I'm here to express my support for House Bill 3201A, which will give the Oregon Liquor Control Commission a new tool that will enable the agency to address problem liquor licenses through appropriate administrative sanctions. Although most bars and restaurants operate in a responsible and reasonable manner and effectively address problems that arise in their communities, a small percentage of establishments continue to be a tremendous drain on state and local resources and have a significant impact on neighborhood livability. House Bill 3201 would allow the OLCC to impose restrictions on a license of a premise that has experienced certain serious or persistent problems. Although a criteria does exist to allow the OLCC enforcement staff to address liquor establishments with a history of serious and persistent problems, that threshold has been set too high by case law. As a result, the OLCC has been reluctant to act in some instances where the city considered grounds for immediate action. For example, the commission concluded they could not issue an administrative sanction for a history of serious or persistent problems when a licensee in Portland experienced two separate on-site shootings. In the commission's experience, while the two shootings were serious, they were not likely to qualify as persistent. Similarly, there are establishments with persistent problems that require regular police intervention, but do not meet the threshold of being both serious and persistent until the problems have been experienced by patrons and by neighborhoods for way too long. For example, it was only after 100 calls for service in a 12-month period that the commission felt confident in issuing this type of violation. Even then, an administrative law judge reduced the recommendation of cancellation to just restrictions, a course of action that we would have liked to see happen much earlier. By allowing the agency to become involved earlier in circumstances where there are serious and persistent problems or persistent problems, the OLCC will have the much-needed authority to address these issues before serious problems become persistent and persistent problems become serious. The City of Portland greatly supports strategies that will require engagement to resolve these problems in a timely manner and preserve neighborhood livability. Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Questions for any of our neighborhood advocates? Yes.
Yeah, I do have a question. You said, I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how big a problem this is. So could you have any data that says the past year, 2 years, why this has been a problem, how it's become a problem? Because it seems to me if it's a small percentage, is this really a solution looking for a problem?
Okay. Senator, Chair Metzger and Senator Schrader, it is an immense problem with a small percentage of licensees.
And what is that percentage? Is
1 to 10% per year that would actually have these serious or persistent problems, but they require a tremendous amount of police intervention. Every weekend, the same 10 to 25 premises are visited by officers. We get the same complaints by the same neighborhoods from the same officers that have to do with everything from noise and trash to serious public safety issues in which people are hurt, people are hospitalized.
I guess my question is then, is this more of a local problem that should be under the auspice of the city as opposed to a statewide legislation that's affecting a broader area of where, again, I'm just trying to get a sense of where are the problems occurring, how large they are, and if you already don't have opportunities to fix it.
I understand. Chair Metzger and Senator Schrader, I completely understand what you're saying, but I think that because the state agency has preemptive authority over problems that occur at licensed establishments, the hands of the local government are often tied. Because it's the liquor license itself that makes it inherently welcoming to the public. They continue to operate in these establishments where people are invited to come even though there are known problems that are occurring there. Currently, if there was with this particular tool, if there were documented problems such as shootings, the OLCC would then have the authority with this tool to come in and require the licensee to come to the table and discuss what it is that has led to these problems, how we can prevent them from occurring in the future. At this time, we can do that at the local level, and we do. We do that problem solving. But it's all on a voluntary level. In this way, if the OLCC is granted the authority to go in and place restrictions on the license itself and makes it part of their licensing agreement, it requires that those licensees that are major problems that are not willing to work with us voluntarily to come to the table.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. Paul Romain, Burke Nelson. And while we're at it, why don't we have a representative? There's two of them in the room, at least one of them in the room, from OLCC come forward. Might have a question. Two of them, but only need one. Yes.
I'd be happy to answer any questions on that.
Okay. Some people have suggested you guys are very tight.
Pardon? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm actually here at the request of Bill Perry from the Restaurant Association to speak to you in opposition to House Bill 3201. A couple of things. As you well know, I've practiced in the liquor law area for a long time, and actually at one point in my life actually represented the OLCC. House Bill 3201 basically is unneeded. What really is needed at the OLCC is more enforcement personnel. You don't need to change the law. You just need to give them the tools to actually enforce the law that they currently have. They want to do the right thing. They just really don't have enough resources. The problem with the bill as it sits right now is it's internally inconsistent. You basically have a violation if there's serious and persistent problems, and that was intentional when that was drafted, because you don't want something where it's just maybe one serious problem that occurred and then nothing else occurred. It has to be persistent, and it has to be serious enough to do something about it. And frankly, exempting off-premise establishments from this is ridiculous. If it applies to a restaurant, it should apply to an off-premise establishment. It's the same neighborhood problem. So the whole bill is internally inconsistent. Cities already have nuisance laws that they can enforce. They don't need the OLCC. They just get a little lazy and they want to have somebody else do their enforcement. And the OLCC, frankly, already has the authority under law today to put restrictions on licenses. So this bill basically is unnecessary. If there is a problem with an establishment and the resources are there, the OLCC can do their job under current law. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Mark Nelson next, who has had a metamorphosis since signing up. Welcome.
I think I look better in a dress than he does, Mr. Chair. Erica Hagedorn, Republican.
I haven't seen him in a dress yet, but thanks for warning me.
Erica Hagedorn, Public Affairs Counsel, here today on behalf of the Oregon Restaurant Association. I'll just echo a few of the points that my colleague Mr. Romaine made. Current law is written that OLCC can restrict or pull a license for a licensee if there's a history of serious and persistent problems. The bill, the proposed language, is serious or persistent problems, which we feel severely lowers the bar and reduces the options for the OLCC when there is a problem. We also feel that the definition of serious problem not only includes problems like drug sales and fights, which may be on or near your premise, but also noise. And we feel this could disadvantage establishments that host large groups or festivals. So we hope that the committee can consider opposing this bill, letting the OLCC work under the current language that works for most circumstances. So thank you.
Okay. Before I go to the OLCC, questions of any of the two industry representatives? Okay, I have a question for OLCC. If you could give me your independent analysis of how you would operate differently under 3201 than you would operate today.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs Director with OLCC. I think what this bill does, if it was passed, would give us an additional tool to, as the previous speakers have talked about, not having to wait for a long history where there are serious problems occur, where instead there may be one or two incidents that are fairly serious, that we could take action in terms of putting restrictions on a licensee at an earlier date, and then that certainly gets the licensee's attention, perhaps more than just violations or tickets along the way over the course of time, because restrictions can result in a suspension of a license if they violate those restrictions. So it's an additional tool. OLCC actually helped draft this language in the work group, so we're fairly comfortable with the language. That answers the chair's question.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Senator Schrader.
Yes, can I extrapolate this to mean that you see this as a huge statewide problem in restaurants and establishments that serve alcohol?
Chair Metzger, Senator Schrader, no, I don't think we can characterize it as a huge, widespread problem. I think what happens is we do have instances where this would be used sparingly. This tool, if it was enacted, would be used very sparingly. And there's probably a little bit of a trust issue here with industry and the agency. Keep in mind that if we go down this road, if this bill got passed, we would still draft rules that would create guidelines about how it would get enacted, when it would take place, and the industry would be involved in all that rulemaking. So to characterize this as a huge, enormous problem statewide, no, I couldn't do that. Is it a problem? Yeah, I think in certain situations it is a problem, and it's an additional tool, as I say, that would help give the agency an additional way to address some of these problems.
Senator George.
In the other testimony from the City of Portland, they discussed that they're somehow preempted from, the way it sounded like, from some kind of nuisance ordinance that would allow them to regulate this, and I can't think of anything that would, in your guys' regulations, in the OLCC's regulations, that would preempt local governments from doing preemptions. So I'm trying to figure out why the cities couldn't do this themselves. Why would you guys need to get involved at this point?
Chair Metzger, and Senator George, I'm not sure I'm the right one to ask that. I'm sure cities have some additional tools in their kit bag as well that they could employ in certain circumstances, but I don't know if that's your question.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, do you have anything that preempts them on their nuisance ordinances at all?
No.
Okay.
Not to
I just want to make sure. Thank you.
Mr. Romaine.
Mr. Chair, if I might give you a particular case that happened a few years ago, actually. About 10 years ago, 12 years ago, there was a restaurant in the Pearl District. It was a new restaurant there that had a lot of... It basically was one of the first restaurants in the Pearl, and it became the focal point for all the new condominium owners who thought they moved to Lake Oswego but actually moved to the Pearl District where there was actually noise. And what happened was that restaurant had somewhere between 100 and 150 complaints a month to the OLCC, and an organized effort over a series of months to, in effect, close them down. They've got a sympathetic OLCC field officer who is working with them. And the complaints, literally, I will quote one of them, was a man stood outside a restaurant at 1 o'clock and talked loudly on his cell phone. There was another one that the person drove a car by the restaurant that had a squeaky fan belt. And it got to the point of being absolutely ridiculous. It was a concerted effort. The problem is and we literally had to change the noise law to keep from being closed down, that restaurant from being closed down. The problem is that that was a persistent problem in their minds. Was it serious? If it had gone over a long, it went over a long period of time, so it gave us a time to react to it. But by making this serious or persistent, it was a persistent problem. It wasn't serious, and it could be handled, and it's got sort of ridiculous. But by changing the law, you can lead to some real abuse problems. I think you have a good balance right now, and that's where you ought to leave the law.
Any other questions for this group? Okay, thank you. Representative Shields, if you would come forward, and I understand the legislative assistant for Representative Kodak is here. And first of all, I want to apologize. I was just thinking olive oil when I saw you the whole time. I was not thinking this bill, and then I all of a sudden had a brain freeze moment that you were also on this bill. So I apologize for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, when I showed up, I realized I have an interest in about half the bills that are before your committee now.
I don't know if that's a good thing.
primarily, I am here for the olive oil bill, a very important public health bill. But Representative Kotek's legislative assistant's been working on this. But before session even began, in my district and in her district in North Portland, neighbors have been very, very frustrated at taverns where gunshots are not uncommon, and where the neighborhood association has found it very, very difficult to intervene in some of these cases. And I think this bill is all about providing an interim tool to address some of the frustrations of OLCC to get at the problem, as well as the nuisance coordinators for the city to have the tools they need to deal with these problem establishments. But Representative Kotek's assistant knows more about the mechanics of the bill, so I will pass it off to her.
Okay, and for the record, that was Representative Chip Shields. Yes, welcome.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Tiffany Ryder, and I work for Representative Kotek as her legislative assistant. I will do my best to summarize her testimony so that I'm not reading to you. The key points are that this is a tool. It's an interim step. We did start in changing the language from and to or, as mentioned before, and we did sit down with the Oregon Restaurant Association and also the Grocers Association, and were able to get on the same page with the Oregon Grocery Association. However, the Oregon Restaurant Association, we did make some changes, and the OLCC did draft some language in efforts to make improvements so that it wouldn't affect such a large group of people. And in the end, we came up with this tool, which is an interim step. Instead of currently, when there are serious and persistent problems, their option is to give a violation, and this violation can lead to a cancellation of the license. This step is simply a restriction, and it's also a restriction on a shorter list. So if you'll notice in the bill, instead of being the entire list of possible problems, this is only a shorter list of problems that could be either serious or persistent.
Okay.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the representative or... Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is anyone else would like to testify on House Bill 3201? Okay. Colleagues, I've been asked to move this bill to the Rules Committee so it can be considered. I would appreciate doing that. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session for the purpose of moving this to the Rules Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move that we send House Bill 3201 to the Rules Committee.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3201 be referred to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion? Any objections?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure without recommendation.
Without recommendation. Yes. He did not make a recommendation.
Definitely without recommendation.
He did not make a recommendation.
My druthers, I'm not a big fan of the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to vote no on the bill.
Okay. All right. I note Senator George's objection. We'll go to the Committee on Rules for
the rule.
and see if it has persistent and serious problems there. Okay, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2553, Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2553A requires the Department of Transportation to pay reasonable costs for removal of vehicle cargo or debris resulting from a motor vehicle accident resulting in death of a person age 18 or younger in cases where there is no insurance available and the family of the deceased would otherwise be responsible for paying for the cost of the cleanup. It specifies that the measure does not apply in cases where the deceased was engaged in criminal conduct. Give the dash A3 amendment, which requires that the vehicle of the deceased have been insured under motor vehicle liability insurance policy.
Okay. Amy Joyce, would you come up? The proponent of the bill is Representative Bruin, who has joined us. I just have Amy to come up and be ready after we're finished with the introduction by the sponsor. Welcome, Representative.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair of Committee. Thank you for having me today. House Bill 2553 comes to you after a constituent came to me about a year ago. Constituents in the audience, his name is Bill Sawyer. Bill's son and his son's best friend died in a horrific traffic accident around Thanksgiving of 2007. His son's name is Daniel Sawyer. Daniel was fully insured, but because of the situation, it was a double fatality. There was pretty horrendous property damage. As you can imagine, the insurance was exhausted, and at the end of all this traumatic time for the family, after all this is going on, Bill and his family get a bill for roadside cleanup from the contracted towing company. Bill came to me very, very humbly and suggested that this probably wasn't right. He'd had some experience he'd done some research and determined that in California, as an example, there's a set-aside fund that would take care of the situation so parents wouldn't be burdened like this. Other states, Washington, as an example, they just take care of it. Oregon is by our research, fairly unique in that this situation would arise, and ODOT wouldn't, at the end of the day, take care of all of this. So, Mr. Chair, I know your time is brief. What this bill would do is just say that if you have a situation like that, the A3 amendments make it clear, fully insured, as long as there's no wrongdoing, no laws are being broken, there was a fatality of a minor, an insured minor, that after all other methods had been exhausted, insurance, whatnot, that at the end of the day the parents would not get the bill for that. This is not retroactive. Bill Sawyer and his family would not stand to not benefit at all financially from this bill, but they do stand to serve, and we've made the point that it would be a lasting memory to their son, Daniel, so other parents in this situation that will face all the unimaginable pain and suffering still won't have to go through this one last this one last piece of harm, if you will. So with that, I would urge your support, and I'm fully supportive of the A3 amendments.
Thank you, Representative. That was Representative Scott Bruin.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for the representative? Okay. Ms. Joyce, you have signed up on, we'd be interested in ODOT's position.
Thank you, Chairman.
With the A3 amendment.
Members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, just quickly. At the scene of a fatal collision on a state highway, the district attorney and the medical examiner, actually the people with jurisdiction over that scene, and typically Oregon State Police become their agents at the scene and are running the show. ODOT typically shows up as essentially traffic control. And so what Oregon State Police typically do is they do an investigation at the scene, clear the road as quickly as possible, and often call a private tow company to tow the vehicles to a secure location to continue the investigation. So I think that's the situation here that Representative Bruin has described, where a private tow company had this bill that was sent along. This was not a bill from the department. So what the bill would do is exactly as Representative Bruin described. There are certain very limited situations where ODOT would essentially end up paying that bill at the end of the day. The exceptions already in the Angrost bill are for when there's a preponderance of the evidence that a crime was being committed at the time by the deceased, or in the A3 if the vehicle in which the deceased was riding was essentially uninsured, then these provisions would not apply. So that's what the bill would do.
Thank you, Ms. Joyce. Any questions? Thank you. Let's close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2553.
Move the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2553.
Senator Starr has moved the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2553. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a Duke House recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2553A as amended to the floor with a Duke House recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you.
Senator Schrader, would you carry that bill for us in the Senate?
With pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, we've got one more must-do bill, and then we'll go to some public hearings and go from there. Let's see. Let's open up the work session on House Bill 3099. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3099A modifies the exclusive farm use exceptions. You have the -A10 amendment, which deletes the disposal of solid waste from EFU exceptions. It allows expansion of existing public schools, private schools, aerial fireworks, display businesses on EFU lands that become non-conforming uses. Notwithstanding the change in zoning ordinance, that was the former A7 amendment. It authorizes counties to amend land use regulations by December 31st, 2010 to conform the bill without public hearing and adoption of findings. That was formerly the -A8 amendment, and it requires construction approval, construction of approved replacement buildings to begin by January 2nd, 2010.
Okay, and we've heard this bill and the amendment before, but Mr. Cleve, Mr. DiLorenzo, do you want to add anything at all? Is there anybody else who has any comment on the -A9 amendment to 3099?
This is the -A10.
Oh, the A10 amendment. The -A10 amendment to House Bill 3099. And would you articulate, just to give the major difference between the 9 and the 10?
The difference between the 9 and the 10 have to do with the addition of the -8 amendment, which is the provision that authorizes counties to amend land use regulations by December 31st, 2010 to conform to the bill without public hearing and adoption of findings. And then you have a small provision which requires construction of approved replacement dwellings to begin by January 2nd, 2010. I give you the page.
And that was the one I believe Mr. Schleck testified on, the -8.
That's section 15.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure if we testified on that.
So the A10 encompasses those both.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, Senator.
I move the -A10 amendment to House Bill 3099.
Senator Starr has moved the -A10 amendment to House Bill 3099. Discussion on the amendment. The objection to the amendment. Okay. Senator Starr.
I'm going to vote no.
Okay. Senator Starr objects. That's okay. Senator Starr.
I'll move the bill. I'm going to vote no on the motion, but I'm going to move the bill as courtesy to the chair as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3099 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll start with the comments. I think this is good policy for our farms. I have a particular interest, as both my colleagues on my right and left also mentioned about schools. In my particular case, this helps ensure that they almost all in EFU in Hood River County. And I want to be sure that we track and have a part of that discussion. I know Senator Schrader has a part of this bill that involves a constituent. Mm-hmm. So I think for the good values of the bill, as well as the interests of members of the committee, I think it's very important that we maintain some control over this piece of legislation. Is there any objection to the motion? Senator George, Senator Starr. Okay, it goes to the floor. I will carry the bill. Thank you. Okay, now, let's see. Who's all in the audience at the moment? We've got Ag. He is here. Representative Shields. Representative Call is here. Do we have anybody? Who's here on 2375? Do we know yet? That one, the fireworks bill.
Will there be anybody? I've not heard of anyone.
Okay, and colleagues, I gave you some a document that I'd like to have you kind of follow along with me on these bills. The next four bills we're going to hear, the chair does not have a particular view of, and I would take the lead of the committee on these, but we're going to hear them. So with that, I will begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3122A. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3122A allows an Oregon Liquor Control Commission full on-premises sales or limited on-premises sales licensee to obtain upon the health inspection or reinspection of the premises verification of the capacity of pint glasses used for draft malt beverages. It allows the licensees to obtain a display sticker from the OLCC if glasses at the premises hold a pint of malt beverage under standard conditions. It allows the Department of Human Services to charge a fee for the verification and for the OLCC to charge a fee for the decal, not to exceed the cost of providing that decal.
Thank you. Oh, we got a prop. Is that
Mr. Castillo, our committee assistant, brought a glass from the Ukraine that is marked here. And mm-hmm. points out that in some...
It's also empty.
We considered whether we wanted to do anything about that, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, okay, interesting. Representative Bailey, come make your case to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey, and I have the honor of representing Inner East Side Portland, House District 42, sometimes known as the heart of Birvana. And I would say that after a long session in which you have engaged in an enormous amount of work, and especially last week's work, couldn't you use an honest pint? This bill allows us to certify, or allows for a voluntary program that would allow businesses to apply for and receive a sticker that they could put in their window that says, this establishment serves an honest pint. What is this bill trying to do? This bill is intended to address there's a perception that there are some establishments that serve what is sometimes referred to as a cheater pint. These are very difficult to distinguish from a normal pint. They have a thicker base and sometimes a narrower top and serve somewhere on the range of 14 ounces or so, depending on the style of the glass. Now, a business can choose to serve beer in any amount that it wants and can market that beer how it wants, but we believe that if it's going to be called a pint, it should be at least 16 ounces. It could be more than 16 ounces as an imperial pint, but it should be at least 16 ounces. This is a simple bill. Again, it's a voluntary program, and what it essentially does is allows for a business during the course of their normal health and safety inspection to request that their pint glasses are measured, that they are certified to be capable of containing at least 16 ounces, and the capable is important because that means we're accounting for the foam at the top of the beer. It is capable of holding at least 16 ounces, and if that is the case, then they can get a certificate, hand that certificate to the OLCC, pay a fee for the sticker, get a sticker and put it in their window, and they are a certified honest pint establishment. We see this as a marketing opportunity for a great industry here in Oregon that's helped put us on the map. Again, there's full cost recovery for the agencies that are involved through the fees. If businesses choose to participate, then they'll pay the cost of that participation. If this is not a program that people think is worthwhile, then nobody will sign up, and it'll cost the state nothing, and we're out nothing for having done the bill. A couple other quick points I want to hit. I've had some questions in the course of going through this. Why are we looking at certifying honest pints? Why not an honest bowl of soup or an honest name your other product here? I would submit that by definition, a pint is intended to contain a specific amount of liquid, much like when we purchase a gallon of gas, we fully expect it to be a gallon of gas. And we have a weights and measurement system set up to certify that that is, in fact, a gallon of gas. A bowl of soup might be of different sizes, other products might be of different sizes, but if it's going to be marketed as a pint, then they should be able to boast about the fact that it's an actual pint. Again, we're not trying to create a heavy-handed regulatory system here. We're trying to create a market-based opportunity, a fun way for businesses to promote themselves. You might imagine an iPhone application where you could press the button and it would tell you all the certified honest pint establishments around you, and you could go find the nearest one. There are a number of different things that we could do with this, but the first step is to provide a method for an independent verification if a business chooses to market that. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Representative Bailey. Questions for Representative Bailey? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Isn't there an association of well, it's a restaurant association, but I'm thinking, isn't there an association of, like, the beer Brewers Association. That's what I was thinking of. Couldn't they do this, like, through their association? We don't have to use OLCC at all?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Starr, that's a great question, and it prompts me to say a couple of things. One is that we received no testimony in opposition to the bill on the House side, and the ORA, Restaurant Association, is neutral on the bill. It is true that an association could go through the process of figuring out how to set this up themselves. I would say that sometimes it's very difficult to tell the difference between a cheater pint and a regular pint to the naked eye, and sometimes there are incentives to serve one or the other, but what this would do is set up a independent third-party verification that would allow for that certification to give the public, when they see the sticker, the knowledge that, yes, in fact, it's working. And while I understand the desire to create a very simple system, I think having a system like this that pays the full cost of it, if a business chooses to be part of it, it's not costing the taxpayer dollar a thing, is a fairly simple system.
Senator George.
I guess, Representative, what I don't get is, why don't establishments who have full pints or whatever just put a big sign out in front and say, we serve full pints? I mean, if they really want to use it as an advertising thing. I mean, I'm not quite seeing the role of the state in this. I think what you're saying is a great idea, but I'm not sure I see the role of the state, because why wouldn't the businesses just hang their own sign out that says, we serve an honest pint, if that was actually truly a marketing thing that they wanted?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, they could do that now today, hang a sign out front that says, we serve an honest pint. But I would, again, bring it back to, for example, a gas station. We don't trust gas stations to hang a sign outside that says, we serve a full gallon of gas with your purchase. We have an independent way to verify that. Now, because serving a pint of beer may not rise to the level of importance of making sure that we have a full weights and measures system that we have applied in other places, we decided to make this a voluntary program, but we did want to create an independent third-party verification that a consumer could trust. Yes, in fact, they do serve a full, honest pint. And I would submit that, in some sense, they already do advertise that they're serving a full 16 ounces by calling it a pint. A pint is, by definition, 16 ounces, or in the case of imperial pints, more. So they are advertising to the public that they are serving a full 16 ounces when, in fact, they're not.
Another question? So under this other piece of legislation that is moving through the body right now on the menu labeling, would they, if it was a labeling for the calories, would that be on the honest pint or on whatever they're serving, and might that misguide someone thinking there's more calories or less calories than might be in that particular pint or less than honest pint?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question that I probably can't and shouldn't try to answer.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bailey.
Thank you.
Bill Eminger, Christine Lewis, and Jeff Allworth. We've got two proponents, one opponent, and so I will ask Christine Lewis as a proponent to begin, then Bill Eminger, and then Jeff Allworth. So we kind of balance that discussion here.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Christine Lewis. I'm a resident of Milwaukee, Oregon, and I thank you very much for considering Bill 3122A. I'm here today in support of this bill. What started just about a year or so ago as an interesting idea among friends that soon spread into the blog and the blogosphere is now here in front of you today, and I'm finding that pretty exciting as a true grassroots uprising. The grassroots uprising that has brought it this far demonstrates that there is a clear demand among the consumer base, so that is one of the reasons that I'm supporting the bill. One objection that I've heard is that there could be a staggered start time amongst different bars and restaurants that would display this decal based upon when their inspection is up and the actual measurement would take place. I think folks who are watching this, who are engaged, and who have been following it thus far would understand that, and venues would not be at a disadvantage. Further, it's a voluntary program that helps avid, albeit responsible, beer drinkers like myself know exactly to the fluid ounce what we're drinking. So I am here today in support of 3122. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lewis. Mr. Eminger.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to provide comments today related to House Bill 3122, the Honest Pint Bill. I've passed around to you the verbiage of my comments as well as a couple of attachments. One is my fiscal analysis of the bill.
If you would identify yourself for the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Bill Eminger, and I'm the Environmental Health Director for Benton County Environmental Health. There's a couple documents that I'm passing around. One is my comments. The second one is an attachment, which is a fiscal analysis of what I think the cost of enforcing this bill at the local environmental health program level would cost. And then the third document is a paper from the Conference of the Local Environmental Health Supervisors. The Conference of the Local Environmental Health Supervisors are your environmental health directors in your various counties, and they are in opposition to the bill. It has been my pleasure over my 30-year career to promote environmental health programs at the local, state, federal, in academia, and with industry. I'm currently, as I mentioned, the Environmental Health Director for Benton County. Environmental health programs have a responsibility to prevent the transmission of foodborne and waterborne diseases and to ensure the health and safety standards are maintained in the communities that we serve.
If you could, just in interest of time, we do have your written testimony. If you could get just directly to the part that deals with this bill, I would appreciate it, just so we can get through our agenda.
Happy to. The environmental health program looks at a broad range of health and safety concerns, whether it's foodborne illness, waterborne illness, et cetera. This bill in its current form pose very vital public health and environmental health resources away from doing our primary task and responsibility. As an environmental health manager, one of the things that I look at is my staff and their productivity in terms of being able to address things like hazardous waste sites, addressing situations like animal bite investigations where we're looking at trying to prevent the spread of rabies. And this bill would be a distraction, I think, to our ability to provide that service. Also, our inspections are unannounced. If we were to have to arrange a time to meet with the restaurant manager to enforce or implement this rule, we would have to compromise the integrity of our inspection. The recommendations I have are a couple. One, I would recommend removal of language for requiring the Department of Human Services to write rules or enforce this regulation. And by extension, that would take local environmental health and local health departments out of the picture in terms of trying to enforce this piece. The second piece, as I believe some members of the committee have pointed out, there is a state agency, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, does have a weights and measures program that might be a more appropriate house for enforcing this regulation. I believe they also do the enforcement for at gas stations in terms of measuring the amount of gasoline that's being dispensed. The other piece is, OLCC might be a better fit since they are required to enforce liquor laws. And the other possibility is looking at having some nonprofit organization, non-governmental organization, maybe enforcing this requirement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mannion. Yes, Mr. Allworth.
My name is Jeff Allworth, and I kicked this thing off on the grassroots level, and I think the current legislation you have mirrors my Honest Pint project pretty closely, so I'm fairly familiar with how it's laid out, and I think Representative Bailey covered a lot of the main points, so I won't reiterate all those, but I will say there's two things that I would shade slightly differently. One is the issue so he mentioned the shaker pint problem where the 16 and 14 ounces look quite a bit the same. But in fact, pubs and restaurants across the state have all different kinds of glasses they serve pints in. So you may get anything from 12 ounces of liquid if it's a cheater pint all the way up to 18 or 19 ounces if it's an imperial pint. And so there's a lack of standards. So when you walk into a pub or a restaurant, you order a beer, you order a pint, you have no idea how much liquid you're going to be served. And since $5 is about a standard price for a pint of beer, the difference between 12 and 18 ounces is quite substantial. So I think this legislation introduces standards. It defines what a pint is, much like a gallon of gas. You know what a gallon is, so you can assess when you drive up to a gas station to look at the price. You can make an informed decision about how much that gas will cost you. That you could do the same when you walk into a pub. The second thing this does is it brings transparency, so everybody can compare these things. And I would argue that this is a pro-business move, because businesses also have to compete on this unlevel playing field. And one pub that serves $5 imperial pints is, if the customer is not aware that pint glass is bigger, they walk into another pub where they have much smaller pint glasses, also $5. It's kind of an unfair playing field. So this would set standards where everybody could compete on the same playing field. We'd understand, we'd have the standard of a pint established by the state, and we'd have the transparency so people could make their own decisions. One comment too on the weights and measures. When I first started this, I actually contacted the state agency responsible for that, and got a letter back talking about how understaffed they are. The person I spoke to said it may actually fall under their domain, but he wasn't certain that even if that was the case, he would have any recourse in terms of going out to pubs. Every pub and restaurant in Portland, or in Oregon almost, serves beer, so it's a huge enforcement issue. The legislation you have in front of you, because it's voluntary and because it's a one-time thing, means that there's no beer cop out there trying to find who's cheating. So I think this is a much more elegant and easy to implement solution.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Allworth. Questions for any of the witnesses? Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 3122? All right, we'll close the public hearing for the moment on House Bill 3122, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2375, Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2375A discontinues within 1 year of taking effect an exception created in 2003 allowing fireworks businesses to use land zoned exclusively for farm use.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify in support of House Bill 2375? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2375. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3047. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3047A directs the Tri-County Metropolitan Transportation District of Oregon to implement a pilot project to use volunteer greeters on light rail station platforms to greet users as they board vehicles and to report problems and or concerns to the district or appropriate law enforcement agencies.
Okay, Representative Call has been patient. I actually saw Representative Smith come in, but if he comes back in, we'll move him up as well.
If he could sit in that chair, I'd appreciate it.
Would you, is this a prop for the record? Is this a honest pint?
I wish. I bring enough to share, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. I just want to make sure here.
For the record, I'm Representative Nick Call from House District 49. Thank you for taking the time to hear this today and letting me come in and speak briefly. I'd like to note that among the many differences between the House and the Senate, this Transportation Committee starts on time, which is a testament to your leadership, sir. I would like to just briefly say... this is not a monumental bill. I know it's not. It's not an earth-changing bill like what we've done, especially with the Joint Committee in passing a massive transportation package that's going to benefit our state for many years to come.
And thank you for your support of that, Representative Call.
It is my pleasure, sir. I do think, though, that this bill represents a small part of the vision of the transportation package, in that with Senate Bill 34 and House Bill 2001, there is a new commitment made to public transit and those systems. Part of that commitment to public transit that we've made, I think, is represented in this bill as well, which is the fact that we not only need to fund public transit, but we need to make it a place that people feel welcome. We need to make our light rail system a place that people feel is their own as part of a public transit system, as a piece of the public trust. And so what this bill attempts to do is move us one step in that right direction. People in my community, in Rockwood, in East Multnomah County, live with a perception that public transportation is unsafe, and therefore they choose not to ride as often as they should. One thing that there are many options out there. Most of them are very costly. We've taken dramatic steps, TriMet has, to fund police officers on the MAX line, and to make sure that there is adequate police enforcement. But there are many of us, at least a few of us in the House, who think that part of the real merit of TriMet is the fact that the MAX system is an honor system, that it runs really pretty effectively without significant fare enforcement, without having hardened stations, and that costs are lower because of it. And so what we're trying to do here is twofold. It's simply to bolster the honor system and to allow folks, average citizens whose transit system it is, to become engaged. TriMet is working hard through different areas to encourage people to call in when they see bad behavior, to be very active and vigilant in maintaining their stations and taking ownership of the facility. And this is just one step further. And what this bill does simply is it asks TriMet to do a program where we have volunteer greeters on the MAX station talking with customers. And the hope is twofold, that we bring to the MAX station a better sense of community, a better sense of public ownership, and engage the average rider in a bit of volunteerism. And it, like I said, it's not earth-shattering. It's not, 2001, a transportation odyssey, right? It's a small bill. It doesn't cost any money, but it might allow a few folks in my community to take ownership of this significant part of their public trust. So I'm here for questions.
Thank you, Representative. Two of your colleagues have come in. Why don't you stay there, and we'll ask Representative Smith, Representative Matthews to come forward. Start with the firehouse before we go to the doghouse. So we'll have Representative Matthews speak first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm a state representative of House District 50, the great city of Gresham. Originally, I volunteered to come here as part of this group because I wanted to add a little eye contact or eye candy to Jefferson Smith's proposal here. But in all honesty, I thought it might help him out a little bit. But we're here today to talk about what I think, as I talked to a couple of the senators and did a little legwork on this initially, is not a very substantive bill, is what it was told, and I respect that comment. What this bill really does is it's a reasonable approach to a problem and a reasonable solution to a problem. And if you just think about in terms of a greeter identifying people, making eye contact with people so that they could identify later if there is a problem. But I want to just talk about the process itself and some of the concerns that might have been raised in our past meetings. This bill comes with support from law enforcement. A big concern of mine was whenever you're asking citizens to get involved, it's a concern of law enforcement as well. What is going to be their enforcement component? What is going to be their interaction with the community? Well, none of this is to put them in harm's way or in threatening circumstance. It's about situational awareness, and that training will come from TriMet. The recruitment will come from TriMet, and this will all be part of a steering committee, of which law enforcement wholeheartedly supports and will participate in. Just the other night, we had a town hall meeting, and we actually had Wally Kuhn, friend of mine who's a night supervisor for Gresham Police Department. And Wally had stepped up in front of the group and said he supported this bill because it was a great effort to have citizens involved towards their own safety, and it would give them a communication tool for early detection for problems. And being a firefighter and being a past police officer, early detection does lead to prevention. And if we can get citizens who want to participate in this program that want to be the early detection for the problem, I think we can start solving some of that and getting more folks to ride the mass transportation. So it is just, again, we could say not real significant, but I think it's a step in the right direction. I think it does make a difference. It will impact safety to our citizens and will encourage more ridership. So having said that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Representative Jefferson Smith, unless you have any questions for me, Senator.
No, that's fine. Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do obviously hope you'll move the bill and forgive me my youthful indiscretions on other matters. One of the biggest issue in my and our districts as we were going, and I can at least speak for myself as I was going to door-to-door, was impression of safety on the max. And it was to the degree that there wasn't a single time when transit came up that somebody didn't say, I won't ride, or I won't let my wife ride, or I won't let my daughter ride. Okay. I started keeping track, and I honestly don't believe, and saying on the record, and this isn't the first time I said it on the record, that I don't believe there was a single time when I was at the doorstep when those things weren't said whenever Max came up. Now, I am a rider of the Max. I do not feel endangered while I'm on it, and I am about 6'4" tall and 200 and more pounds than I wish I were, and I know that other people have different statures. So I started meeting and had good conversations with my colleagues and also met with my local law enforcement and heard three different proposals for how we address safety on the MAX. And coming first to testify was and has been intended to be a victim of a MAX accident. He is harmed enough that his travel has made it hard for him to get here. I believe he is might be even sitting back there as arrived as I've started speaking. He may arrive a little bit later in the hearing. As my staffer said, he moves as a snail's pace because of his injury. The three ideas were the following. First, close the system. Not shut it down, but turnstile. Make it so you can't get on a platform, can't get on a train unless you go through a turnstile. The challenge of that is, not only is it very expensive, but it's darn nigh impossible in many of the stops. Right. Second proposal was more uniformed police officers. TriMet has done some of that. It has helped. The challenge is every pair of officers we add, when you talk about training, benefits, salary, equipment, is $250,000. So we can't play that game that many times, particularly in this fiscal picture. If we came by with a significant law enforcement additional package this legislative session, you know, it wouldn't just be, you know, jokes and a hopeful yes, and it would be a I'm real sorry, but we just don't have the money for anything. The third idea that was discussed first with my local precinct captain was a two-pronged plan, only the second of which is covered as a pilot project in this bill. The first portion of the idea would be visible ticketing. So instead of printing out a little ticket, I stuff it in my pocket and an officer, a transit greeter, figures out who's actually paid and who hasn't, you do the same thing we do with cars, park downtown, print a sticker, wear it. If you're a monthly rider, wear a lanyard. If you don't want to put it on your suede coat, hold it in your hand. So when an officer is on a train or on a platform, they can see immediately who has paid and who hasn't, because we know that fare compliance is one of the single best indicators of safety on public transit. So you have that naturally on a bus. You walk on a bus, and there's a bus driver right there. And they might be a little grumpier than you'd wish, but at least there's a set of eyeballs that you know has been watching you and might watch you if you go do something stupid in the back. We don't have that when you ride the MAX train, right? Because our drivers are locked away in the front car, generally speaking. The second part would be the matter of the pilot project in this bill, and that would be a system of transit greeters. Nothing magic about them being volunteers, except it might work and it would be cheaper. What we know about other contexts, including most studied retail sales, is that if somebody sees somebody who says hello to them as they enter Fred Meyer, if you go to Fred Meyer, somebody says, hey, thanks for shopping Fred Meyer, go to Walmart, thanks for shopping Walmart, it's not because those companies are trying to be nice. It's because they have data that suggests and proves that it reduces significantly shoplifting. So
trying this out, the bill that just covers the greeters portion and just a pilot project, working in conjunction with TriMet, and already begun getting commitments for steering committee members from local law enforcement to put together a plan so we wouldn't overly burden TriMet's also challenged budget, and we could start working with community members to do recruitment and define the extent of that pilot project, I think would be at least one step and a signal to send that we're going to continue to pay attention to something that is an enormous issue in one sector of our state. Received a 9-1 vote in the House committee without one no vote, then voting yes on the floor. Received 53 ballpark yes votes on the House floor. I hope you will, again, move the bill and forgive some members their youthful indiscretions on other matters, and happy to answer questions.
Okay. Who knows? We might give you an opportunity to do it again. Questions of the committee for our esteemed guests. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Is there anything that would preclude TriMet from doing this pilot project short of passing this bill? I mean, couldn't they do this without us telling them as the state legislature that you got to go run this pilot?
Yeah, Senator Starr, that is absolutely correct. TriMet could do this and probably will do this if we don't act. The value of this, of enacting this piece of legislation, is that it sends a message to our communities that we are taking charge, as it were, of the situation. The problem with the max line isn't that it's dangerous. The problem with the max line is that it's perceived to be dangerous. And so while many other times we do things in this legislature or may avoid to do things in this legislature that may otherwise happen, with this piece of legislation, the perception actually does matter. It actually does matter that we send a message to our community that we care about the max line, that we have a plan for how to make it safer and how to involve our community in that. And so I would hope that while your reservations or the issue you address is well-founded, in fact, exactly accurate, I do think that this piece of legislation does have value even besides that concern.
Yes, Representative.
I'd say a couple things. I'd like to have full confidence TriMet would do it without this committee and the legislature acting. My general answer is I think the application of energy can prod results. I think that the conversations that began with this bill have moved forward the conversation. I think the killing of this bill would move backwards the conversation. And my good friend Olivia Clark is here, and I want to be as respectful as I can, and I think that the conversation around this bill have moved forward a conversation. In addition to everything, I think it was accurate of what Representative Call said about sending a signal that, hey, yeah, we're doing everything we can. Folks ride because we're going to make it safe. It is safer than you think. And the more people that ride, frankly, the safer it becomes.
Yes. Other questions for the representatives? Yes, Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to add that having been in law enforcement in 1987 and having Max come out to East County and, of course, move throughout the West, Max used to be perceived to be a way to have criminals transport from, you know, folks committing crime in Gresham and transporting themselves quickly and safely into Portland and vice versa. So you would get the theaters and you'd get the malls and you'd get all the folks within that transport area victims of crime, and you'd have car prowls and those things. It has escalated over the last 2 decades into being something that we're now seeing where violent crimes are occurring. This is no longer about a theft or a car prowl or somebody that, you know, runs through G.I. Joe's, hops on Max, and they're 20 blocks further in 5 minutes or less. That's not occurring any longer. What is occurring is the violent crimes on Max. So, you know, in terms of whether we need the bill or not, the bill ensures that this happens, which is a step in the right direction. Without the bill, we don't know if it would. And I wouldn't want to doubt the fine folks of TriMet. I would just simply like to encourage that they do this. And thank you, Mr. Chair, again, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Matthews. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
The gentleman that just came in.
I'll do that. Yeah. Any other questions for the representatives? Representative Smith, if you want to escort, your guest has arrived, and he's from my hometown. But if you could bring him up, that would be wonderful. And
sure.
Thanks for that acknowledgement, Senator Berger.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
You got a good team there. Welcome, Mr. Chilko. Why don't you say your name for the record and talk to us a little bit.
My name is Lori Chilcote. I live in Sandy, Oregon.
The mighty, wonderful, beauteous Sandy, Oregon. Thank you. Well, I think a lot of the members are familiar with your experience, and not everyone. So why don't you give us a brief comment on your experience and your views on House Bill 3047.
I believe that without, since the bill is specifically for people who are traveling by public transportation, that they should have, as users, part of whatever kind of solutions need to be manifest themselves. Some of these young people have some new and different kind of ideas, which I hope can work. We have to improve the quality of public transportation, particularly in metropolitan areas. I don't drive, and if there's no way to get there by public transportation, I don't go, which can be very annoying. But when I do use public transportation, I want that transportation to be efficient, person-oriented whenever possible. I want the powers that be to see to it that we don't have too many people who are rowdies using the public transportation for their own purposes only. We have one of the better systems of transportation in the country, but there's always room for improvement. And many people feel that it is getting too expensive or too problematic to get on. And many of my peers that I have worked with in the schools, they've stopped going there to volunteer their services because they can't travel as safely as they would like. It's a shame because we've spent billions, literally, of dollars, and the whole purpose of that program is to ensure public transportation, with the emphasis on the word public. And TriMet is facing a lot of problems, trying to deal with them systematically, but they need all the help they can get. And I think there should be a real effort to include as many people in the process who actually make use of that resource so that they don't feel alienated. A lot of times I've heard people say, well, I can't go because there's nothing that goes near there. And when they realize there is a line going into the area they want to go in, then their next problem is how to deal with some of the people that are on the MAC system or the bus system, and they're behaving badly, and there's not enough citizen participation to encourage them to, if necessary, step in and police it themselves. That doesn't mean they should act like a policeman, but it does mean that they should keep their hands on the pulse of what's going on and let people know. Just because you bought a ticket to ride doesn't mean that you own the MAX or the bus system. And you may have noticed my condition. I used to have perfectly good legs until some little rowdy on the Gresham line took it upon themselves to maybe wail on me to see if he could control me or something. there's a dearth of parental involvement in a lot of these public places and tools that are out there, because the parents use their car and they don't know what the kids are doing badly. In some instances, it reaches pretty horrific conditions. You can't blame TriMet for that, per se, but I do think that we should institute some kind of a program that is open to the public and will have consequences for those who misbehave before they wind up harming people, which they have done in the past. And the programs that are out there that allow senior citizens and children especially to use such a tool are, I think, essential. Not everybody has a car. I don't. If I want to get around, I have to find someone kind enough to pick me up or drop me off. But
well, one of the good things is you have Sam now. To take you into Gresham to get on TriMet. Mr. Chilcote, as the committee may remember, after that his brutal assault, what sparked our committee to do some actions on TriMet safety. And I know it's not the way to initiate action, Mr. Chilcote, but I, you know, so we appreciate the attention, but not how it came about. But we're glad you're doing better. Is there any questions for Mr. Chilcote?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think he's an excellent witness. I just want to compliment you. You certainly gave good testimony, and I'm very sorry about what happened to you. And I think that being able to have the ability to go when you want to go and to get out and to do things is extremely important, and particularly later in life when you have the time to do it. And so I hope that this kind of thing can help, but certainly it needs some improvement.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chilcote.
You're welcome.
Mr. Smith, you might escort Mr. Chilcote back, and then I'd like to have you stay for a second.
Sure.
I'm going to do something a little different here because I have a serious question. I have some expertise in the audience, so I'm going to ask Representative Barton and Mr. DiLorenzo to come and join Mr. Smith up here because I need attorneys. I'm serious. Come on up. Now, keep in mind, I don't need necessarily all three comments just because attorneys feel like, you know, you're not in the quarter hour now, so you don't have to. But I have a serious question, and I thought maybe with your collective expertise, you might be able to help us with that. And I'll ask Ms. Clark to comment on that, too. So go ahead and sit down, John, and Representative Barton. Thank you for taking the time to come to the committee and watch us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to learn how laws are made.
Yeah. Here's a question. And Ms. Clark, you might should go ahead and come on up right now. Here's one of the concerns I would have with this, and I want to see if they're based at all. This is requiring TriMet to have this pilot program using volunteers as greeters on your system. Okay? I'd be curious as to just on its face, does this create any liability issues? They're acting as an agent, but they're a volunteer. They're not an employee. And, you know, in terms of their interaction with someone, does that create a liability for TriMet or additional liability for that individual? That's one issue that I have on this, and just wonder if there's any on its face thought about that. Mr. Barton, why don't you give us your thoughts?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair.
Because they're acting as an agent even though they're not employed, and that's where my concern is.
That would be correct, Mr. Chair. First, allow me to preface my comments by mentioning how much I appreciate the colleagues whom we've previously heard from. I was honored to vote for this bill on the House side. Allow me to say that to the extent that yes, Mr. Chair, I think there would be, it's called in law, respondeat superior, i.e. they're agents, and thus to the extent they breach their duty of care or were otherwise negligent, it would be actionable against TriMet, I believe.
Ms. Clark, Is your agency, as you identify yourself, tell us, is that an issue or how might that be addressed if we move forward on this?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet. Yes, Mr. Chairman, there are liability issues. I don't know what the technical terms are that Representative Barton just used, but I did run it by our legal department, and they're quite concerned about liability issues when it comes to the use of volunteers. However, I would like to say that the testimony earlier was very eloquent. I very much appreciated it. I appreciate the intent that the sponsors bring to the bill, and I also very much appreciate the testimony from Mr. Chilcote. We do have a program of working with neighborhood associations at their request, and we come out and we provide a program called See Something, Say Something, so that we do teach them what to look for, what kind of behavior, and what to do with that behavior, how to respond to that behavior, who to call, under what kinds of circumstances. We've been very resistant to guardian angels in the past who have come to us and wanted to be on the system for these very liability issues as well. So there may be a middle path here in training neighborhood associations, short of having volunteers standing on platforms as an official agent of TriMet.
Representative Smith or Mr. DiLorenzo, do you have any comments on the legal thing, or, and if so, how we might ameliorate that problem?
Yeah, I have a few thoughts. The first is we should be really clear that these folks would get trained. Second, they would be trained and instructed and sign liability waivers so as not to intervene, but merely observe and report. The third thing I'd say is TriMet has a liability challenge right now. The testifier you have right now is a pending lawsuit with TriMet. We're going to get lawsuits from people getting beat up, and we're having them already. We're going to get lawsuits if we allow vigilantes, because people are doing this now. Not only do we have rider advocate programs, we've got churches starting to recruit people. I mean, this is a big enough problem in my community, right, that there is a demand to do something. And if we don't act, somebody's going to act, right? And people are starting to now. And if that happens and we don't stop it and it still happens, I think that could be a subject of a lawsuit as well. If we stop it and people get hurt and there's a record of trying to keep other sort of private sector safety efforts away, that could also be an additional line in the lawsuit. My hunch is, overall, the liability risk of TriMet is best served by making TriMet most safe, by reducing bad incidents. And if this is, the pilot project, something that might help do that, my guess is the net liability impact would be positive. But certainly, one of the reasons we wanted to use broad language and call it a pilot project is we work with TriMet, work with law enforcement to make sure we resolve those issues.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Senator George.
Sure. Olivia,
for our esteemed panel.
Yeah, Olivia, I guess I'm trying to figure out, you guys don't have any volunteers right now that you guys currently cover with liability insurance? I can't imagine a way why you couldn't cover volunteers with some kind of liability coverage under some kind of umbrella liability coverage. Or
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, to my knowledge, we don't use any volunteers. Actually, the Victory Outreach, I think that might have been referred to, and rider advocates are all paid. Mm. We use paid staff when it comes to directing traffic or being on platforms to move people around, tell them where their bus is, that sort of thing, how to make a connection. But I'm not aware of any volunteers that we're actually using. There may well be some way to deal with that, but that's not something that our legal department is very excited about.
Okay. Senator Starr.
Thank you. For Olivia, the seems like I just read in the last couple of days that TriMet is reduced service, bus service, and frequency of MAC service based on budget issues. This pilot, while it's the use of volunteers, so there won't be, you're not going to be paying folks, there will be some cost to the agency to monitor, put this together. Is there a way that this could be contemplated in TriMet's budget? What does this do as it relates to the overall issues of providing transit service, needed transit service to the citizens in the metro area?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I appreciate that question. We are cutting service right now, and I suspect that we'll be cutting more service. This is just the first round, both on MACs and on buses. We're trying to do it very surgically. We're trying to do it in a way that doesn't hurt people. We're looking at low-performing routes as well as those places where people have other alternatives, and actually getting down to the individual level to make sure that people are okay. I'm not sure we can do that on the next round of cuts. Because this is not, the volunteer pilot program is not defined in the bill, it hasn't received any kind of a serious fiscal impact on our part or anyone else's part. I think if you decide to pass the bill, we'd have to figure out how to deal with that. I'm not sure how we would, but we would certainly, and I've said before, work with the sponsors of the bill to figure something out. But it's not free, ultimately.
Ms. Clark, if we did not pass this bill, Representative Smith pointed out that you're very interested and expressed some willingness to do some things, but that for legislation things may move faster. Can you give me an idea of what the TriMet would do if we did not pass this bill? Would you do anything along this line or not?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the question. I have indicated to the sponsors I'm very willing to work with them, or TriMet is very willing to work with them in the interim to see what we can do. I don't feel that we're in a position right now to recruit volunteers for some of the same reasons I just stated. However, we're more than willing to work with the sponsors and Representative Smith in particular to try to figure out what we can do that fits within our current constraints as well as deals with liability issues, because that really is a strong concern, and I appreciate what Representative Smith said about liability, but I'm more than willing to work with the bill sponsors in the interim.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Starr.
So, since I don't know that I've had Ms. Clark in front of us recently, I have a question as it relates, broader question as it relates to TriMet. I know there has been ongoing discussions about Fairless Square. And I happen to be one that believes that it is a conduit for the kind of riffraff that Mr. Chuklot was talking about. Is there a plan to address this issue in a way that would require folks that get on the MAX anywhere along the line would have to pay a fare?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, there's certainly been a lot of discussion about that, particularly in light of budget cuts. There was a consultant hired to do a report to interview all the stakeholders on Fairless Square. I think that the consensus proposal by that group was to change Fairless Square so that it would be moved off the buses and onto MAX only, given that there'll be a new line, two new lines actually running up and down the downtown mall. There has not been a formal proposal made to the board of directors. I think in the next round of cuts that we'll be looking at, I have a feeling that that may be offered up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you all for your participation, voluntary or otherwise. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3047, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2893. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2893A requires the State Department of Agriculture to adopt rules establishing standards for identity, quality, and labeling of olive oil. It specifies minimum standards. It creates unclassified misdemeanor penalty for distribution of imitation olive oil. You have the -A3 amendment, which deletes the specific standards for olive oil from the proposed statute, and it also deletes the penalty.
Welcome again, and thank you for your patience, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chip Shields, State Representative for North and Northeast Portland, bringing forward to you a significant public health concern. So imagine that you have an allergy, and you are allergic to peanut oil, and you walk into a store, and you buy olive oil, thinking that you are buying, in fact, what you are buying is olive oil. The problem that this bill addresses is that making olive oil can be an expensive endeavor, and there is a growing body of evidence that some companies are cutting corners, and by cutting corners are putting the health of those with allergies, people who have allergies like peanut oil allergies or soy allergies, at risk. And so passing this bill will help protect both olive oil consumers and producers, and there's also a few pioneering farmers in this state who have shown that Oregon is a surprisingly hospitable place to grow olives. So I hope that I can become a winner in our contest of House Legislative Idol, in part based on the concision of my testimony. I will now pass it off to Paul Knowles, who brought this idea forward.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Knowles, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, and committee members. My name is Paul Knowles, and I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. I've been in the state of Oregon since 1974, and I am a barber. My family's been in business here since 1963, and I am a small businessman involved in the olive oil industry. In the last 40 years in the United States, the olive oil industry has been allowed to run basically rampant. There has been no standard set for olive oil in this country, and what happens is if you have someone that in your family that's allergic to peanut oil, soy oil, or other tree nut oils, there is a 90% chance that when you go to the store and purchase extra virgin olive oil or olive oil, that it is not olive oil. It has been adulterated. The New York Times just recently done a study of 75 bottles of olive oil, and only 4% of the olive oil was unadulterated. The state of Maryland has just passed a bill to regulate standards for olive oil. Connecticut has came on board. California, New York, and New Jersey are also looking at passing legislation. Oregon has always been a leader in things of that nature, and I'm here to ask for your support today. With the medical profession pushing people to use olive oil because of the health industry and raising cost in the health industry, you've been asked to take your health into your own hands. So with that, when a doctor or someone in the medical profession asks you or recommends that you start using olive oil, you would want to know that when you go to the store to purchase olive oil, that's what you receive. And I think it's fair, and I think that your constituents and the people in the state of Oregon deserve the opportunity to have that chance.
Thank you, Mr. Knowles. Yes, Senator George.
I didn't realize that peanut oil was doing this. It's a very serious issue, and obviously in food processing,
yes,
which is my business. So most stores now require you to do disclosure before you sell to them, to retail, of any cross-contamination with allergens such as peanuts and other tree nuts. Why isn't that structure working?
Absolutely, that is absolutely correct. And what has happened, it does happen in other industries, but it is not happening in the olive oil industry. Like I said, in the last 2 years, it's become a real issue. And there's a reason that other states in the country are coming on board with this type of bill, because there has been no plans by the FDA or no plans on moving forward with this type of legislation. So no, it is not happening, and that's why we're here today, to ask for your support to make it happen.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, just so you know too, we've discussed this with the Grocers Association, and they feel like this wouldn't inhibit their ability to do business because they feel like they're maintaining those standards, so they're supportive of the bill.
Other questions? Senator Berger.
Yes, I guess What proof do we have that they have substituted peanut oil for olive oil?
Senator Metzger and chair members, Senator Verger, there has been a test ran recently in the state of New York by the New York Times, and it was uncovered that there were oils that contained peanut oil and other food allergens. Also, the state of Connecticut, the reason that they just passed their bill, there is an olive oil vendor in that state who is 91 years old, who has been in the olive oil industry for over 53 years. And he also discovered that there was peanut oil in the olive oil in the state of Connecticut. So that is the proof that I'm offering.
Okay. Have you found peanut oil in any olive oil on the shelves in Oregon?
No, I have not. I have not actually ran a test on the olive oil in the state of Oregon. But 20 I would say that 80% of the olive oil in the state of Oregon comes from other parts of the country. We have distributors here of olive oil, but and that would be so. But no, there has been no proof. The science of the farming of extra virgin olive oil and olive oil only allows for 10% of the total crop to be extra virgin olive oil. That would be olive oil that is unadulterated and processed in the proper way. That is the science of the farming. So when you go into a grocery store and you see 90% extra virgin olive oil on the shelf, that is not possible. So there is a very good chance that the oil is, as has been adulterated. This is something that's been going on, and it's just been raised in the last 2 years, and it's taking a hold across the country. And I think that we owe it to our constituents and our citizens here in the state of Oregon to come on board with this bill, because it will happen eventually.
Okay, what I'm going to do, thank you very much for watching my clock. We have Department of Ag and Ag. Would you like to comment on this bill? I would like to hear from the Department of Ag about this bill. Briefly. Yes, go ahead, Senator Schrader.
This might be a question for the Department of Ag, but just let me throw this out there. As someone who uses olive oil all the time, oftentimes I buy imported olive oil from other countries, Italy, Spain, so on and so forth. So does this affect those products, or is this just locally grown in Oregon olive oils? I'm confused, because
Mr. Chair.
There's some international trade things here.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Schrader, it is an international problem. It is a worldwide problem. If, in fact, you would like to research and get more information, you are able to. If you just simply Google olive oil fraud, you will see how important this issue is and how bad it has gotten in the United States.
Okay, thank you. Let's ask the department to come up for a moment and give us your analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me I have Ellen Lehman, who is one of our food safety managers, and if you have some technical questions, we'll defer to Ellen. It is true there are not specific standards for olive oil. Our department, though, does not really have a lot of experience with the issues that are being talked about here regarding the peanut oil and those kinds of things. I don't think we've received too many complaints on that issue. However, that being said, like anything, when you start looking for things, sometimes you find those things. We did work with Representative Shields and his constituent on an amendment to give, if this bill were to pass, our agency the ability to adopt standards using really a variety of protocols out there, not just one. I think the original bill that was engrossed had a pretty specific menu of standards that would be met, and our recommendation was that we not hard code those in the statute. As other standards and this issue becomes more prevalent, I think, nationwide, we want to be able to adopt our standards and adapt them to those. So.
Okay. Thank you. And that's, you're referring to the Dash A3, I believe.
I am.
And you're comfortable with that amendment.
Senator Metzger, we are, yes.
Okay, Senator Starr.
Real quick, do we have any examples of any Oregonian that has eaten olive oil and it's had a reaction to it because it had peanut oil in it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, none that I know of. And by the way, you know, Mr. Knowles is simply a small business person. He's not representing the Olive Oil Association or anything like that. So he's just brought this forward as an idea. But I think it's fair to say that probably the olive oils that have been used, that were tested in New York, were probably national or international brands, and those would certainly have been sold in Oregon as well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing, House Bill 2893, and the committee's going to be at ease for a moment. Senator Berger, will you give back recess. Let's open our work session on House Bill 2893A, olive oil. Senator Starr.
I'd move the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2893.
Senator Starr has moved the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2893. Discussion on the amendment. Objections to the amendment. So ordered. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2893A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I don't have any objection to this bill, but I would like to get on the record one concern. We're fixing a problem locally that seems to be a national problem, and I might suggest that you speak to certain members of your congressional delegation if this is indeed an issue. I know of one in particular who sits on the Ag Committee that you might want to look at it from a larger perspective, but I certainly can get here on this particular bill. Thank you.
And I would add, Representative Shields, make sure that it is an honest pint of olive oil. Any other questions? Objections to the motion? Senator Berger, do you object to the bill? Okay. Then there are no objections. House Bill 2893A with the fourth of due pass recommendation. And who would like to carry the bill?
I love olive oil.
I will ask Senator Schrader to carry olive oil to the floor. Popeye would be proud. Committee, we'll close the work session on HB 2893A, and I want to say to the committee, thank you very much for your very, very hard work and diligence this session, and I appreciate that. I really appreciate all the great ideas that the committee brought forward to bills that I think really improved some of the pieces of legislation that we had. I really, really do appreciate that, and appreciate your service, too, on the Joint Committee on Transportation. Of course, we'll be doing that bill tomorrow, and everybody's input and contribution to that has been extremely valuable, and I appreciate it very, very much. We probably will have a gathering sometime next month, but we'll figure that one out, you know, and we will greet you with honest pints and all kinds of good stuff, with olive oil and everything.
Honest pints.
Mr.
Honest
Chair, pints. Just appreciate your leadership and your willingness to entertain the ideas and notions of your committee members.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
I want to thank you for letting me be your administrator.
And thank you, Mr. Stembridge, for being our administrator. You've done an excellent job.
I would like to just mention, too, I have appreciated having you as chair. I have learned a great deal as a new member of this body from you, how to run a meeting, how to engage people, and I have really appreciated and enjoyed working with you, as well as the rest of the committee.
Thank you. All right, with that, we are adjourned.
Okay.